Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about AI-assisted genome writing, where we turn to AI to help us design new species that don't exist yet. And where is all the water coming from? If, like me, you've had a cold or COVID or the flu in your house for the last 14 years, you probably have been affected by the dark grey and rainy skies that we've been having for some time. And it is a reasonable question to think, how is the rain continuing? Like in the water cycle, the rain comes down, but then it dries up or it goes into a lake and then it's gone from where it is in the skies. It seems like the skies have this never-ending supply of rain this week. But the funny thing is we don't actually know where rain comes from. We're going to be finding out about that on the podcast. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. If you want to chat with us, email is the best way. Old fashioned. It's kind of like, you know, sending a message on a horse. Email now. We'll get to those comments at the end of the show. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady, Insight Research Ireland Centre for Data Analytics and DCU researcher, and Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist at UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with cervical screening.
Yeah, so this is some research coming out of China, and it's talking about looking at alternatives to cervical screening for cancer. And as we know, look, when it comes to cervical screening for cancer, regular on-time screening is critical. And the researchers coming out of China actually said millions of women don't attend these appointments. Ireland, I had a little bit of a dig to see a kind of in terms of Ireland, what we look like. And in Ireland, we've actually got one of the highest rates of attendance of these appointments. So roughly one quarter of women do not participate within the recommended 5-year period, which is kind of shocking, because these screenings, they can prevent up to 75% of cervical cancers. So there is welcome research coming out of China that says menstrual blood testing could offer a non-invasive alternative to this traditional cervical cancer screening, and it can even be used at home. So in China, between 2021 and 2025, there was more than 3,000 women taking part in this research, and they are aged between 20 and 54. They all provided 3 samples for testing. So a menstrual blood sample, which they collected using a sanitary pad and a strip. Then they also provided a cervical sample, which was collected by a clinician. And then there was an extra sample collected by a health worker for processing in a lab. And they found that the testing using the menstrual blood collection, so it was like a sterile strip on the sanitary pad for high-risk HPV, which is that cancer-causing virus, it can detect precancerous cervical abnormalities with an accuracy similar to the clinician-collected cervical samples. So this is just absolutely amazing, I think. And the negative predictive value, so the probability that a negative result truly rules out disease, was actually identical in both methods.
Oh.
It's much more acceptable, perhaps, for some people. It's more convenient, inclusive, and it potentially could encourage more people to participate, I think.
Absolutely. And you know, in the privacy of your own home, a strip or something that can give a very quick test, you know, I guess in the future, you know, there could be results sent to the lab, but like a very, very quick test, that sounds great. Did it matter in terms of age or in terms of how heavy the period was?
Well, no, I think as long as it was, so it's suitable for people who are menstruating regularly. So
right, yeah.
The ability to test this way would not work for everyone, obviously. So for instance, women who are menopausal, it's not going to be effective. But look, it's again, it's in the research phases. Larger, more diverse studies are needed before it could be integrated into any kind of national screening program. But it's encouraging stuff, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I was going to say, surely we won't even need it in 20, 30 years' time because we have come up with a successful vaccine for HPV, which is what causes cervical cancer. But of course, that it's actually not a certain future anymore, which is absolutely terrifying. You know, that my son's in second year. He's been given the HPV vaccine, which is amazing. So it means he won't give that virus to someone else, and that and he won't be, you know, not responsible, but will not pass on a virus that could develop as cervical cancer. That we have that, and that we could absolutely get rid of this disease in a few decades' time, but may not be able to do that because of attitudes is crazy.
Measles was eradicated in the United States not that long ago, and now it's back with a bang. And same here.
Yeah, it's just that's the one thing that really makes me out, particularly cervical cancer. But I suppose any intervention that makes people more likely to take part in screening, and we know probably one of the reasons why we don't have as high a level of screening here is because of the history that goes with that and failures. And also expectations of what screening programs is and the communications around it. It's all quite tricky, but anything that gets better results for outcomes when it comes to cancer is very welcome. Shane, our second story has to do with bonobos, which are horny chimpanzees, essentially.
Yeah, I want to tell you about a 43-year-old bonobo, a little younger than me, called Kanzi. And Kanzi is the subject of a paper that's published from John Hopkins University in the United States, published in Science, so really high impact stuff. And what they've done is they've put this bonobo, that's like a chimp, into a scenario where he has to do play and make believe. And what they found ultimately is that he's able to conceive of things that are not there, which is remarkable. He's showing he has an imagination. It was, or perhaps still is, thought that this is something that marks humans as unique. So for a long time, the ability to use tools was a sort of a zoological way of showing the uniqueness of humans. And Jane Goodall's work, again on primates, showed that that wasn't limited to us. This work is suggesting that our capacity to imagine things, in other words, to know and imagine and to use our minds to picture things that are not physically in front of us, it was thought that this was unique to us. This study shows it's not. And what they did was they took this bonobo called Kanzi and they put him into a very rich, playful scenario. It was a kind of a tea party. What the researcher did was sat at a table with the chimp and put two empty cups and an empty jug in front of the chimp. And then they picked up the jug, which was transparent so the chimp could see there was nothing in it, poured the imaginary liquid into a cup, and then asked the bonobo, where is the juice? Where is the liquid? And it got it right all the time. And then in order for them to rule out...
You mean it pointed at the space where the imaginary cup with the imaginary juice was?
Yes, and it picked it up and gestured.
Oh,
like,
picked it up?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
Play. Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of cool. So it was like, I know what to do here. I know that your behaviour is sort of suggesting that there might be a sweet treat involved. In order for them to rule out whether the bonobo thought maybe there actually is juice here, you know, maybe I just can't see it, but there is juice, they did it again, where sometimes they put juice into a cup and had an imaginary cup next to it, and they'd pour the imaginary liquid into a cup, and this time the bonobo always got the juice right. So it didn't care what the researcher was doing in this scenario. It was like, yeah, I know what you're doing, but I'm going to take the juice. They repeated it with grapes, and they found exactly the same scenario, mimicking kind of grapes, eating grapes and handing out grapes, and the animal played along.
But I mean, with a number of different primates, we've seen communication. I want this, I want to play boats. And how is this different cognitively in the brain? What's different about this versus someone saying, I'd like to go for a walk, and a chimpanzee making the motions for walking, or an umbrella if it's raining? That's what, because we know chimps can do that.
Well, and to some extent, like, other animals can do this too, right? You can point at things with dogs and they'll know where you're pointing, but it's not the same. What they're suggesting, and what I think they've shown in this paper, is that they're able to conceive of things that are not there. So they're able to use their imagination and play along and act as if it were there. So when they're gesturing, normally it's sort of, I want something, or they're in a scenario where it's a kind of a here and now situation, right, rather than a kind of an imagined or contrived situation. Interestingly, children start to do this typically around the age of 2. And it was thought that that was unique to the human species. This is the first time they've seen this sort of imaginative behavior in non-humans.
You know, currently we believe, you know, coding is a human only exploit, but who knows?
Well,
give them time, we'll be like
100 monkeys 100
years
100
from right now. Exactly, 100 years from now, we'll be like, researchers have shown that monkeys can now code basic websites.
Yeah.
And we used to think this was just a human expert, but actually...
Monkey apps.
Yeah. Shelley.
Yes.
Our second story has to do with AI reading MRIs.
Yeah, this is really exciting stuff coming out of the University of Michigan, where researchers have developed a new artificial intelligence system that can interpret brain MRI scans in seconds, but not only this, flag urgent conditions. So potentially, again, it's at the really early stages, but this could transform emergency diagnosis and radiology workflows. So the AI model they've developed, they've called it Prima, and they trained it on a huge amount of MRI studies. So 200,000 MRI studies and 5.6 million imaging sequences. But not only this, that's been done before, looking at kind of narrower tasks, like looking for lesions and, you know, risk of dementia and things like that. But what they also did was they combined it with patient histories and why, the reasons why the doctors ordered each MRI. Mm. So it was then working as a vision language model or a VLM. So it was able to process images and the clinical data together. So much like a human radiologist, rather than focusing on those more narrow tasks.
Right. So instead of just pattern recognition, it was bringing in context.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is that a new idea? It doesn't feel like it's, you know, it's particularly difficult to come up with that idea. I'm surprised that hasn't been done before.
I think what was happening before was the tasks were much narrower.
Right.
So they were training them on, I suppose, more carefully selected subsets of MRI data.
Right. And so you're saying it's a bit being a bit more generalist at looking at MRI rather than trying to identify a very specific thing. It like looks at the whole image and tries to figure out things.
Exactly. It's a much broader data set. And they evaluated the system. So they used more than 30,000 MRI studies. And the results showed that Prima was able to recognize a wide range of neurological abnormalities with up to 97.5% accuracy. So that's outperforming many of the pre-existing AI tools that may have been there looking at the narrower scope. So they have the disease detection piece, which is fantastic, but it also has an urgency assessment. So it will prioritize scans that require immediate medical attention, so strokes or hemorrhages. And then that link alerts to an appropriate specialist. So let's say a stroke neurologist or a neurosurgeon. And because the feedback is available immediately, as soon as the patient completes the imaging, you're speeding up that clinical response. So it's a really quick turnaround. As we know, that's critical for improved outcomes.
Yeah, I'm thinking of our own health system.
I know.
And just literally heard the story of someone who had sepsis yesterday. And the story is like very depressing. So this is the opposite of that, it sounds like. That figure of 97 something, that must be higher than any human expert looking at these images, right?
Yeah, I think so. But again, look, you're still going to need your experts. You're going to need your radiologists and your clinicians to review these results and decide on the best course of action. So they're sort of, the researchers actually likened it to ChatGPT for medical imaging.
Yeah.
So it's like a co-pilot for interpreting medical imaging, much like we might use it to help us write an email or provide recommendations. It's going to hopefully assist medical imaging.
Very good. Our final story then, Shane, has to do with...
monkeys that have designed an MRI AI machine.
No, it has to do with the skies in Chile, but actually the skies for all of us.
Yeah, so anyone who's gone to the extreme west coast of Kerry or parts of Mayo may be familiar with the whole dark skies parks that are there. So regions of the earth where it's incredibly dark and you're able to see the stars in greater abundance because of that darkness. There isn't light pollution. The best place in the world to put a telescope if you want to look up into the sky at night is probably Chile, right? Because we have... opposite of here, there's no clouds, there's no weather, right, per se.
No weather.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really clear and there's no light pollution because it's out in the middle of nowhere. And so there are a number of global initiatives like the Very Large Telescope, which is 2.5 kilometres above the Earth's, above sea level. It's been responsible for 3 Nobel Prizes and the Extremely Large Telescope that's underway at the moment. Big threat, though, the Chilean government, or rather a company that's operating there, decided, sure, this would be a great place for us to build a big power plant, effectively somewhere where we're going to have 3,000 hectares of green hydrogen and an ammonia production plant, with associated with that, a massive solar farm to power it. There didn't seem to be any reason why they were going to put it right next to the telescopes, but they were. And thankfully, they've pulled back from this and they maybe will put it somewhere else, because it would have really limited the capacity of those telescopes.
Why? Why would a solar panel, because they're supposed to absorb light, not reflect it?
Well, it's just you'd have a lot of activity in the area. You need it to be really calm there. And also, it's not just light pollution that matters, is that there will be various tiny vibrations that would be associated with any technology that you put in, not to mention dust that would be raised from the construction and the engineers going in and out. That dust would land on the mirrors.
Sounds like they're being very precious.
They have to be, though. It's almost like space-like conditions there in terms of making sure your telescope is clean and the atmosphere above it is clean as well.
Give us your authoritative thoughts on Chile or Chile.
Yeah, you sound awful when you say Chile, but it is.
But you said Chilean.
Chilean, yeah. What would you say?
Chilean. I don't know. It's like, I mean, when you talk about the Czech Republic, do you say Chechia?
No, I say Czech Republic.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I kind of feel like we should be saying Chechia, but then do I have to learn all of the
Czechia.
Other...
Czechia. It's not Chechia.
Is it not Chechia?
No, it's Czechia. Czechia.
Right. Yeah. It's written
Capital
Czechia.
Prague.
He's referencing a Do we have time to tell the story? I once met the ambassador of Poland who invited me to Poland and was just about to give me his business card when he asked me, have you ever been to Poland? And you can say two things to that. You can say yes or no, but you can't say what I said, which is, I don't know. Which obviously did not go down well. And then I was like, oh, and I was flustered. I was like, oh God, I can't say that. I said, no, I've been to Pratt. And then he had a business card in his hand and he just put it right back in his pocket. Can you believe it?
Can I tell you about my new show before I go?
You can tell me about, he's dying to tell you about
the
new show.
It's a podcast we're making in UCD called The Observer Effect. So I'm talking to researchers about their lives outside of the university, their backgrounds, their values, and how that has kind of led them to the research they're doing. So it's kind of...
Have they got really diverse? But do you have one who's like a hip-hop star and another person like who goes hiking and that sort of thing?
The research equivalent of that. So
excellent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, very good.
The Observer Effect.
The Observer Effect. Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Shelley Brady, thank you so much. You are listening to our weekly science program. It's called Future Proof. My name is Jonathan McRae. What if the next big leap in AI is life itself? Imagine growing houses like trees, plastics that simply disappear, or writing all human knowledge into a speck of DNA. We are on the brink of becoming something like authors of life, because that's where AI is bringing us if you combine it with technologies like genome editing. Adrian Wolfson, formerly research fellow at Darwin College, University of Cambridge, and author of The Future of Species, Authoring Life by Means of Artificial Biological Intelligence, joins me now. Welcome to the program, Adrian. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And really happy to be on, Jonathan.
So I think the framing of this is nice, that for billions of years, it was just, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, people adapting to their environment and making do, and if they made it old enough to be able to reproduce, then the species typically was successful. And now we've entered into a phase where we can really, with precision, edit genomes. But there's steps on from that. And I think Craig Venter, who we had on the program many years back, you know, was kind of starting, you know, his inroads quite a long time ago into, you know, artificial beings. Where are we with this, and why did you want to write this book?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. And I think the difference between what people like Craig were doing, synthesizing genomes back in the day, is that was quite artisanal in the sense that, you know, each genome was done in an incredibly painstaking way. And essentially, they were more or less copying nature. The big change now, and we have reached this kind of tipping point, if you like, in the history of humankind and of life on Earth, where suddenly we can actually use artificial intelligence to author life from first principles. Now, many of you will have heard of gene editing and CRISPR, for example, and that is a bit like taking a document and redlining it. You know, you're kind of editing a pre-existing document. Mm. What we're talking about here with the generative biology and the ability to design life with AI and build it with next generation technologies is literally taking an empty page and writing a new narrative, a completely new genome that may never have previously existed. And that's the key difference. And my book was written, first of all, to sort of say to folks, hey, this has happened. You know, this isn't about to happen. We've actually created the first artificial species, which is actually turns out to be a virus. And that's obviously not a new type of giraffe or zebra, but it means we're on the ski slope, you know, we're on the ski hump where, you know, the four-year-old kids are just doing snow plows on the 10-foot high mound. But that leads to double diamond black runs, and we're on the pathway to doing that. And my book is really to provide people with a kind of guidebook, except the landscape you're exploring isn't India, it's actually the future of life, which is quite a different landscape. And the key point of my book is that we all need to be aware that this is happening. We need to align on a way to do this safely, ethically, responsibly, equitably, and in a manner that helps humankind and helps society.
Well, let's talk about the positive stuff before we talk about how it may not be so positive. When you say synthesize organisms from a blank page, surely that isn't the best way of going about it. Surely the best way is to use sort of Lego bricks to make something new. Why would you start with a blank page as opposed to snippets of genes and sequences that you could then stick together like a Frankenstein-y thing?
Yeah. So let me take one step back from that and start off with, you know, how do we do this? And we first need to understand the grammar of life. So life has a grammar in the same way that French has a grammar and German has a grammar. If we understand the grammatical structure of life, the generative grammar that enables you to put sentences together and then put paragraphs together and pages and whole books, we can then kind of look at our own biology and say, oh, this is why we get ill. This is why we only live this long healthily and work out how to reverse engineer that. But to answer your question, the other side of it is actually making totally new species. And why might you do that? I'll tell you why. So imagine, for example, that evolution had never discovered the tomato or the banana or maize or rice or rubber plants or cows or chickens, you know, all the things that kind of make our life easy to, you know, give us everything that we need. Mm. And now historical life and extinct life has only kind of explored the tiniest fraction of possible life. So beyond that, you've got almost certainly many, many other things like that, which could be incredibly useful to humans, but that we've just never had access to. So think of it this way, right? Imagine that you were living in a bedsit in Cork with your TV set, getting McDonald's delivered every day.
Dystopian future.
Yeah. And you never left your room, right? And you wouldn't know that down the street there was the water, and then beyond that there was Britain, and beyond that there was Paris, and beyond that there was, you know, Berlin and south of France and India and East South. In other words, there's this whole world out there that you wouldn't explore. And at the moment, we're in the kind of metaphorical, biology is in the metaphorical equivalent of the bedsit in Cork. But actually, there's this whole world of biology out there waiting to be discovered, and that might be totally different from what exists today. And therefore, you need the blank page, because, you know, the blank page enables you to write things which are totally different. Yeah. You know, it's the difference between, you know, taking Seamus Heaney poems and being forced to iterate different versions of them versus writing totally new poetry, which frees you from the past, right?
Yeah. We've already received a number of complaints from residents of Cork over my joke about the bedsit. Oh. In fact, correcting me that a bedsit in Cork is one of the greatest places to be. So thank you very much.
Yeah, and I've never been to Cork.
17 texts we got on.
Really? I should say to readers, I've actually never been to Cork. I've been to
Belfast. It's a delightful place. It is actually a place. I don't get more texts. I am only joking. It is my second place, favourite place to be honest. So I totally get that, right? But how, I mean, you know, you've got your GACT, you've got these bases that when put in a certain order, make up DNA. And every living thing on this planet, as far as we're aware, uses these four bases stuck together in sequences to make genes, which end up making genomes, and that's everything that lives. When we're talking about synthesizing entirely new things, presumably because the AI can figure out what might work together theoretically, we're still working within the normal parameters of life as we know it, using these four bases, right? Because it is theoretically possible to use different letters.
Well, gosh, that's one of the most sophisticated questions I've been asked to date, and I'm you know, really astonished and surprised in a good way that you've asked me that. And you're absolutely right, because you've touched upon a really key philosophical point, which is that actually you're right. Although historically life is encoded in the four chemical nucleotides, you know, AGCT, that all life uses, there are people working on artificial genetic materials, which they call XNAs, and those have their own properties, and they might be more appropriate, for example, if you wanted to build living things to colonize Mars or other planets, for example. And also people are working, you might know that all living things are built from proteins, and there are 20, and proteins are built from combinations of 20 different amino acids, but they're actually thousands of different amino acids that could have been incorporated into proteins, and that by changing the genetic code, we can actually build novel proteins that incorporate unnatural amino acids. So what you're talking about is changing the actual alphabet, you know, the alphabet of life, and that's also on the cards. That's also possible. And there are reasons why it might be useful for humans to do that in certain instances.
Well, how good is this AI then? I mean, how... Because obviously, you know, if we're going into that area, it's almost like, how long is a piece of string? You know, how infinite is the universe? It feels like, you know, if you ask an AI to create something new and you say, well, you could actually also just not use the basic building blocks of life, these bases, GACT, then how does an AI come up with something that is both new and it thinks is useful? How do you train an AI to come up with something that doesn't exist?
Well, you're actually going beyond what even we're doing. So maybe you should change careers and become a biologist, because you're asking some really good questions. But actually, let's stick to something simpler for now, which is, how can we use AI to understand the existing language of life? Because that's the key, you know, comes before your question, which is even beyond that, right? And the answer is that The generative grammar of life is, as like you said, it's like the grammar that enables you to speak German, let's say, right? Now, right now, we're just at the earliest stages of unpicking some of those grammatical rules, right? And we do that by using AI. So in the same way that mathematics turned out to be really good at helping us to understand physics, you know, how planets, you know, so have their sort of elliptical orbits and how we could send man to the moon and so on and so forth. It turns out that AI is the perfect language to unpick the grammar of biology. Now, our ability to do that at the moment is kind of akin to a four-year-old's grasp of language, you know. So a four-year-old can, you know, can babble a bit and can scribble, but it can't really write very long coherent sentences. And that's kind of where we are in our grammatical understanding. However, one of my colleagues, Brian Hee, has managed to literally write the first ever AI designed virus, right? And which is a new species. If you technically speaking, by the, you know, classical definitions, is a new species. And why did he do that? Well, because it turns out that there are good viruses, right? And good viruses can be used to treat antibiotic resistant bacteria, right? So when you have bacterial infections and no antibiotics can work on them, it turns out that you can use viruses called bacteriophages to kill them. So what he did was to see whether he could kind of optimize the genomes of these viruses to be better at killing bacteria. And in doing so, he created the first ever fully synthetic new viral species.
Yeah, I mean, so for people who are imagining, you know, new types of primates or like unicorns or anything like that, let's just pour a bit of cold water and reality on it. At best, I mean, it would be absolutely incredible if we managed to synthesize the genome of something like a worm, right? or even a tiny nematode, like that level of complexity. We're so far away from making anything other than viruses or bacteria, right?
Just to be clear, what we can synthesize the genomes of existing living things simply by copying them, right? It's not trivial. We're not there yet. And we know we can get there. And I think biology is moving so fast, so exponentially fast, that our ability to understand the grammar of life will mean that it won't be too long before we get there.
We had a guest on the program talking about the dangers of this when it comes to bioterrorism. So let's talk about the dangers here. If you synthesize something that is completely brand new and, you know, it looks kind of like a virus, but isn't necessarily like a virus, it's, you know, it's something brand new. How on earth will you know that you haven't or have created something that kills all life on earth?
Another really good question. We need to ensure that there are guardrails in place. We need to be sure that this technology is used wisely, safely, ethically, equitably, and in a way that benefits society. So yes, there are risks. There are risks with any technology. We can use fire to keep ourselves warm and to cook our breakfast, but we can use fire to burn down cities. The wheel, what a dangerous invention. You know, you can use it to wheel your fruit and vegetables to market, but you can also use it to build a war chariot or a tank. Technology always has a kind of dual use, and the technology itself is morally neutral. It's up to us as humankind to ensure that these technologies are used safely and to put the appropriate governance and regulation and guardrails in place.
I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. And the optimism that you have, I love. And that terrifies me, that it's up to us to put the guardrails on technology. We can't even stop AI from going sentient and wanting to kill us all. The idea that we're going to be able to, you know, regulate this quickly enough, that's a real concern for me. I mean, I really do think the technology is going to be much quicker than anyone
You know, this is a wake-up call for you all. This isn't the future. This has already happened. It is happening. I think there's an immense amount of good that can come from this. I think humankind can benefit enormously. And I think it's part of our kind of being is to progress and allow our imagination to take humankind to new landscapes. But, you know, we need to be aware that some people may use these technologies in ways that we don't approve of.
Well, I'll add death by an unknown, previously never existed species to my list of growing fears about the future. Adrian Wolfson is the author of The Future of Species. All right, time to look at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking about aphantasia, which is the ability to see something in your mind's eyes. You close your eye. If I say, picture a chicken, can you see a chicken, Marge? I can't. Some people can. I have aphantasia. And we were talking about it last week with Professor Adam Zeman from the University of Edinburgh. Really interesting piece. Someone says, if some people can't imagine objects or remember faces, do they dream and can they remember dreams? Yeah. I mean, I have aphantasia. I can remember dreams, absolutely. I don't think they're the same thing. Although, Dr. Oliver Sacks, I had him on the program before he passed, an incredible writer and researcher and neuroscientist. He wrote a book called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And it is, like, if you want to hear the mad things that happen when your brain goes a little bit, just the tiniest bit off, fantastic book. We were talking also about the Northern Lights because we had Dr. Alexandra Ruth Fogg from DIAS talking about the events we've been seeing recently and why we're more likely to see more of these sort of Northern Lights events across Ireland over the next 2 years because we're at solar maximum. And someone says, how does solar maximum impact satellites in orbit? Could it ever cause a global technological blackout? Most of the satellites now are protected and shielded a bit against the solar juice that gets squirted at us from the sun. It is possible that a very powerful one could knock out a few satellites, but they are quite well protected. But that was the real worry, that, you know, when you have these really big coronal ejections, they can have serious effect on machines and space travel and so on.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.